The following is one of a series of spiritual conferences given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J. Father Hardin is a professor of theology and teaches at the Pontifical Institute for Advanced Studies in Catholic Doctrine at St. John's University, New York. Father is well known as a lecturer, retreat master, and author. These conferences are deigned to help anyone, priest, religious, or layman, who is seriously striving for perfection, to advance in the spiritual life. They will be worth listening to over and over again, to delve into the depths of the truths of our faith. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, Inordinate Attachments to Creatures. Father Hardin.
The subject to which we wish to address ourselves is inordinate attachment to creatures. And as always, we might ask ourselves, why talk about this? First of all, because it is so common in real life. So many people are so inordinately attached to so many creatures. And consequently, we ought to know something on how to resolve what is such a universal human problem. Again, spiritual writers say that in the last analysis, this is the only real obstacle to sanctity. I might just mention in passing that in the Church's latest, and will remain for centuries, teaching on the gaining of indulgences, she tells us, and this is in a solemn apostolic constitution of the Holy Father, that in order to gain a plenary indulgence, one must be completely detached from all unruly attachments to creatures, so that the condition for gaining a plenary indulgence is the absence of inordinate attachment. Moreover, when we come to die, sooner than later, we are further told that we are assured of immediate entrance into heaven, provided when we at least come to die, we are by that time completely detached from creatures, that is, inordinately, so that our attachment is only ordinate. There is no inordinate attachment. Saint Ignatius considers this the one thing on which those who wish to strive after perfection must constantly concentrate. It is the normal object of our examinations of conscience. And as, after some years in the religious life, one man can testify, it is the main problem in the spiritual life. So we shall ask in sequence one question about each of the three words in our title. Then for good measure, we'll add a fourth. What do we mean by creatures? What do we mean by attachment? What do we mean by inordinate? And then, well, how do we become detached? First then, these creatures. We ask, what creatures can we become inordinately attached to? Well, the answer is, any creature. There is no creature to whom or to which we cannot be or cannot become inordinately attached. There is only one being to whom we cannot be inordinately attached, and that's the Creator. We can never love Him too much. To spell this out, and just to give a short litany of possible creatures who can captivate us and of whom we can become more or less the slaves, it can be a person, either living or, would you believe it, dead, honest. We can become inordinately attached to a person who is dead. It can be a relative or an acquaintance. It can be a man or a woman, an adult or a child. And disparity of age has nothing to do with the possibility of inordinate attachment. It can be a person who is living near. It can be a person who is far away. Distance seems not to matter. Neither space nor time are an obstacle to this obstacle to holiness. It can be, and this is surprising, one who is also attached to us. No big surprise there. Or one who is not even interested in us. You would think we couldn't become attached to someone who probably doesn't even know we exist. Strange creatures we are. Oh, yes, we can. And indeed, and this is surprising, it can be a real person. It can even be an imaginary one. There are women who are so attached to the man of their dreams that they never really give themselves to their husbands. They're in love with a dream. So much for persons. No, it can be a place. You name it, and we can become attached to it inordinately. It can be a particular country or region, a high place or a low place, the Rockies or the Death Valley. Can be a cold place or a hot place. Can be urban or rural. And by now, after 4 months in New York City every week for at least 2 to 4 days, I've talked to New Yorkers who've lived there all their lives. They cannot understand. They tell you they like nothing about New York except New York. They don't like the dirt. They hate the noise. The subways are a torment. But they love New York. It can be a building, or a room, or, if you please, even a part of a room. And don't you dare move them or their effects to another part. I am speaking in pure abstraction. It can be a thing, material, which is no great surprise, or spiritual, which is a surprise. It can be visible or invisible. Yet after all, this list of creatures is covered at root. The creature to whom we can be most strongly and most easily and most unduly attached is you-know-who. So much then for creatures. Now attachments. Before we look to see what it means to be inordinately attached to creatures, it may be useful to ask what attachment itself means. It's a strange word. Evidently, the term is symbolic. To attach one thing to another is to nail, or glue, or cement, or somehow firmly join one thing to something else, so that the two, as a result of the attachment, are not easily separated. This is a figure of speech. As all things in human life can be expressed only symbolically. Ah, but what they stand for is no symbol, but a reality. Using then this figure of speech, the churches, masters of spirituality, apply it to the affections we have for persons, places, or things. Our affections can be, and in many ways should be, firmly attached to what appeals to us. There is nothing wrong with attachments. What's wrong is when those attachments are inordinate. But we save that for our next step. In fact, unless, say, two people became attached to each other, they would not marry, or better, they should not marry, and they will not stay married. So of our affection for religious life. And for the people with whom we live. This bears emphasis, lest we make the mistake of supposing that because affections can be disorderly, that therefore there's something wrong with affection. No. Oh, no. We better have them. Life would be unlivable without attachment. Let's add one more observation, however, before we get into this business of the inordinateness. We should note that attachments also have their negative counterparts. Now, while most spiritual writers correctly, or shall I say, generally, speak of inordinate attachments, they do not mean to exclude inordinate disaffections. So just as our affections can be unruly, so our disaffections towards persons, places, or things, what we commonly call our aversions or fears, these two, our aversions, or more generally, our fears, can be perfectly natural. If we did not fear height, at the top of a tall building, well, you know what would happen. We'd be callous, and the law of gravity would take over, to which there are no exceptions. It's one law that everybody obeys, unless they wish to destroy themselves. So that these fears can also be perfectly natural and normal, and in themselves are morally neutral. We naturally dread pain, sickness, humiliation, failure, nothing wrong, of which the best evidence is the agony of Christ in the garden. He naturally shrank as a human being from the prospects of death. So much then for attachment. But now this business of inordinate. This is the hub of our subject. Inordinate attachment, which by implication we always also include inordinate fear or aversion. But the word attachment covers both. What makes our attitude towards certain creatures unruly or disorderly? What makes it inordinate? Let me repeat the question with a distinction and answer each part separately. And clarity here is ever so important in acquiring that self-mastery which is at the heart of the pursuit of holiness. First, we ask, what makes our affections or aversions inordinate? What makes for inordinateness? Why do we call certain attitudes disorderly? And secondly, how can we recognize in ourselves when or whether they are inordinate? The distinction is practically very important, because it is not always easy, and that is a very safe statement, to recognize that our affections or fears are disorderly. And in fact, once we realize which ones are and that they are, the task of setting them in order is half done. the most difficult parts of acquiring that self-mastery which we need to serve Christ the way we should, so that our affections and fears, in a word, our attachments, are not inordinate, is to recognize which ones we've got and that we've got them. And not when we listen to a conference, or as in this case, a class on the subject, think of five people who qualify and know exactly. And we are lynx-eyed in our ability to spot the exact area of disorder in other people's lives. It's the moat and the plank of which Christ spoke about. And he knew. First then, what does inordinateness mean? This can be easily answered. Theologically, the essence of inordinateness, that is, in our attitude towards creatures, is that some creature, otherwise good in itself, is nevertheless an obstacle to our perfect service of God and stands in the way of that total following of Christ, which, say, for us, our vocation as religious requires. Or from another viewpoint, there is disorder not in the creature, but in us. Because for us, and that prepositional phrase is essential, for us, that creature hinders our full use of the proper means necessary to reach our destiny. Whether it's heaven, or for us, beyond heaven, if we can use the expression, sanctity. It is not mere salvation, but sanctification. The real problem is the second question, how to recognize. And for that, I thought I would spare myself the trouble of copying from this book, which happens to be mine, on some ways to recognize, and I'm sure if you have had occasion to look at All My Liberty, this, by the way, will appear in the National Catechism to be published in April. Somewhat changed, but this is much too important for everybody. It's under the section called The Way of the Saints. First, assuming that the object that somehow I possess in terms of attachment is not in itself sinful. See, we're not talking about that, because then it cannot be a question of inordinate attachment. We've got to have a positive detachment from a creature which is a sinful creature. No. It is something which is not in itself sinful. I can still be unduly attached to it. And this I can recognize by certain signs. Some are outside of me, some are deeply inside of me. If the object, person, place, or thing, occupies my mind, at times it should be free of such preoccupation, like prayer or necessary duties, or if the amount of attention I give to the person, place, or thing is out of proportion to its objective value and importance. Thus, there's a hierarchy of values. The supernatural is more important than, say, the merely intellectual. The intellectual is higher than the merely material. Some people can be so preoccupied with their bodies as to overlook the fact that they have a soul. There are few hypochondriacs when it comes to spiritual disease. Psychology knows a lot. In fact, some years ago, a big, thick book in medical therapy, which listed hundreds of simulated diseases that people can think they have but don't. They're so attached to their health. Everything from asthma to what's a disease that would end with the end of the alphabet? I think xerosthenia is a disease. Consequently, if I am more concerned with an intellectual project than with my spiritual obligations, to the evident detriment of the latter, I am unduly affected towards things of the mind. If I find myself habitually taking complacence in some possession to the point where I tend to contemn or pity others for lacking what I have, it may be a good thing that I've got, but I'm overly attached to it. I never pity somebody for not having what I have if my attachment to what I have is ordinate. If I often lose peace of mind from definable or undefinable causes on account of what I have or do, I am too attached to the object, person, or practice. Since, if my affection is orderly, it will always produce tranquility of mind, which is the essence of peace. That sentence is worth $1 million. I cannot tell you what a key that is in the spiritual life. Orderly affections produce peace. Inordinate affections deprive one of peace. If I am often afraid of losing or being hindered in the use of some gift or possession, or if I feel dissatisfied with what I have, whether it's amount or quality or perfection, I am too enamored of the object, because the right kind of affection always precludes anxiety. So the other side of the spectrum, justice, peace, is the sign of orderly affection, so anxiety is the sign of inordinate affection. If I regularly talk about my achievements along certain lines, or advertise what I have, and after a few years in the religious life, I of course will have to disguise my by now 50th repetition of that same dear quality I've got. Clearly, my attachment is inordinate. if I am inclined to envy others. This is a very subtle index for some kind of talent, production, or gift, which I feel outshines or obscures my own. I must consider that whatever I've got, I am unduly attached to, because orderly affection excludes envy. If I tend to be jealous of what I have, that's the opposite of envy, which means that I am slow to share it with others, or fearful that others may acquire the same. Imagine? Well, we don't have to imagine. I am overly in love with a creature, no matter how lawfully I acquired it, or even how holy the thing may be in itself. You see, we can be unduly attached even to holy creatures. That's right. Strange, but true. Well, having said that, we still have one piece left. How to overcome our inordinate attachments. As in so many things in the spiritual life, we can express the principle very simply. It is putting it into practice that is hard. The principle consists, that is, how do you get rid of inordinate attachments? It consists in reaching the following attitude of mind. Quote, I decide that I will, if necessary, surrender the creature to which I am unduly attached. Let me repeat. I decide with my mind that I will, then of course that freedom must take over, that I will, if necessary, give up. Surrender the creature to which I am unduly attached. We are saying it is not in itself sinful. Nevertheless, for me it's an obstacle. Now let us add, it may not be necessary to do so. I may not have to give it up. That's not the point. But, so the giving up may not be necessary, but my willingness to give it up is absolutely necessary. And I didn't come by this clarity of expression last night. Now let me go back for a few minutes and see what St. Ignatius, the great master on this subject, says. Why the true test of detachment is the willingness either to keep or to put away a creature to which, before God, I have convinced myself I am unduly attached. Why would have this be necessary? Why is it necessary to be ready physically to relinquish something, whatever it is, a person, a possession, an object, a trinket? The objective value of a thing is no measure of the degree of attachment to that thing. Here we are, very odd. But that's us. Why is it necessary to be ready to give it up as a guarantee that I am detached from the creature in question? Why is it not sufficient, say, to, well, just get my mind off of it psychologically, yet retain the object? The reason lies very deep in Christian asceticism. Any creature I possess and to which I am strongly attached carries with it certain beneficial effects which I enjoy when and insofar as the creature is used. That's use money to illustrate the principle. Less obvious but equally pertinent, for example, would be cultural possessions or even spiritual things. For priests, they like to preach or they like to teach or they don't like to preach, or certain forms of prayer or certain opinions. You name it, and we can be inordinately attached to that thing. My will may become more or less bound to any one of these because I have learned from experience what comfort, pleasure, or consolation they afford me when I use them. But when, after prayerful reflection, I discover that my attachment is out of order, I am faced with the decision of either compromising, and see, well, I'll keep it off my mind, I'll pray about it, I'll make a novena, or of going all out in ridding myself of the affection. See, the nations would have it that unless I am ready to be rid of the thing itself, I am not really sincere in the desire to correct my malaffection. I can't tell you how many people I've struggled with, although this happens to be in print. Believe me, it's in real life. Let's pray for just a moment, and then we'll let go of the subject. Whenever a creature produces an undue attraction, the fault or defect must not be sought in the creature itself. This is crucial, which is our usual tendency, but rather in me. Evidently, this must be true, because the same creature may be safely possessed by someone else with no detriment or even with positive benefit to his or her spiritual life. Why is it a problem for me? Well, you can do all kinds of psychoanalysis. But in the last analysis, it's a problem. Perhaps I have not received the grace necessary both to keep physically and spiritually to profit from the disturbing creature. Some can, I can't. Or I may be lacking, culpably or otherwise, in those qualities of mind and temperament needed to overcome the natural seductiveness of what disturbs my peace of mind. Almost certainly, the state of life to which God has called me makes demands on my generosity and self-sacrifice which cannot be properly fulfilled except at the cost of being freed of certain inordinate affections. No matter. And after you've spent, and some people spend years of diagnosis before and even if they apply the remedy. If, however, I find out that I have the disorderly attachments, there is no objective assurance, it's all in my imagination, that I think I can both have it and not suffer in keeping it. There is no assurance I have of becoming volitionally detached unless I remove what stimulates the attachment, namely the creature itself. There is a limit to my ability to be exposed to the stimulus and to remain ordinately attached. Some can do it. I can't. And even this limit is unpredictable, undefinable, and uncertain. To make sure I am delivered from the troublesome affection of attachment, I must remove its source. The degree of my readiness to do this determines my sincerity before God. Sisters, for this, we need many things. And here we're speaking to all of ourselves. We've all got them. That is some inordinate attachments. It means self-reflection. Hence the transcendent importance of daily self-examination. It means, secondly, absolute honesty with God. It finally and especially means grace, for which we should ask, Lord, give me the strength to be willing to give up stands between you and me. He may take it away. If he does, so be it. If he doesn't, thank him for the willingness to remove what keeps me from God is the guarantee of my also receiving the grace to be able to do it. Sisters, thanks again.